Teatro Lirico in Cagliari, Tchaikovsky's Oprichnik, rarely performed. Gennady Rostevsbensky conducts. The Oprichniki were Ivan the Terrible's dreaded mercenaries. They were terrible. And the opera was banned because of the portrayal of the Tsar. Howard Dick will fill you all in. 1:30, 2:30 Atlantic, 3 in Newfoundland on Radio 2. Radio 1, it's definitely not the opera.
From CBC Toronto, this is the Regional News. It's 12 o'clock. Good afternoon, I'm Lorenda Redekop. It's back to business at the Scarborough Town Centre today. The mall is open. Police had to shut the facility down early last night because hundreds of people were rioting there. Young people gathered in the food court in the early evening after being denied entry into a rap concert at the nearby Civic Centre. Fights broke out in the mall, some stores were looted, and shop owners were ordered by police to lock their doors. According to Toronto Police, one person was arrested. A 22-year-old man faces charges. Police say he was carrying a hatchet. Angry prison guards protested yesterday in front of the Kingston Penitentiary. Among their demands, better pension benefits and safer working conditions. They say contract talks have been stalled for more than a year. Jason Godin speaks for the guards.
Security is always an issue. Staffing, some of the environments we work in inside of the units are very difficult, very dirty.
The guards staged the protest to coincide with a visit from two influential people with corrections. Solicitor General Wayne Easter and Commissioner of Corrections Lucy McClung toured the facility yesterday. However, neither had any promises for the guards. Health officials warn that Toronto area hospitals will experience a massive backlog of patients because of SARS. The officials say there is what they call a tidal wave of patients whose treatments were delayed while hospitals focused on SARS. The delay will affect elective and non-emergency procedures such as hip and knee replacements, cataract surgery, as well as some cancer and cardiac surgeries. Officials say already long wait times could become much longer. Dr. Bill Evans with Cancer Care Ontario says waiting for up to 100 days for cancer surgery is not outside the realm of possibility. Ontario's Integrity Commissioner is taking the unusual step of criticizing MPPs for their behavior in the legislature. Coulter Osborne says it's a public embarrassment. He says the lines have been blurred between normal debate and personal attack. He also says he's not very confident that steps will be taken to alleviate the behavior. His remarks echo statements from the Speaker, Gary Carr. He's frequently complained about the childish behavior of members from all three parties. The Integrity Commissioner, in his annual report, reviewed 292 inquiries. Almost all of them came from politicians looking for advice, often about interactions with their constituents. 19 children from Mexico are in Thunder Bay for the next few weeks to learn English. It's the first time a program for Spanish speakers has run in the city. And as Brooke Latimer reports, the idea seems to be working.
It's beautiful, Canada. It's interesting. It's very difficult to speak English, really.
Natalia Rodriguez-Gomez enjoys a barbecue next to Lake Tamblyn in Thunder Bay. The 12-year-old is taking part in the Superior English Experience program. She learns English words related to a theme each morning, and then she uses her new vocabulary during outings in the afternoon. Rajni Agarwal is the program's director. She thinks the Thunder Bay program will be very popular. She says the city's natural setting is a definite advantage.
Thunder Bay has more to offer than any of the large metropolitan centres throughout Canada. Those are our competition, but they don't have what we have. They don't have the natural resources at their doorsteps. They don't have the fresh water right there.
Agarwal says Mexican parents want their children to experience new things and learn English at the same time. Speaking English means better job opportunities back at home, according to Agarwal. She hopes to expand the program to 500 children in the years ahead. Brooke Latimer, CBC News, Thunder Bay.
And an offer of incentives worth $2,500 doesn't seem to be enough for Wilfrid Laurier University students. Those incentives were offered by the university in the hopes that some students will give up their residence room. However, only 27 students have said they'll take the university up on that offer.
And now your weather forecast as issued by Environment Canada for our nation's capital. Today a mix of sun and cloud with chance of showers, a slight gusting wind from the west at 20 kilometers per hour, a high near 23. Tonight, cloudy with chance of showers, a low near 12. And for tomorrow, a mix of sun and cloud, chance of showers, and a high near 27 degrees Celsius.
You're listening to CBC Radio 1, 91.5 in Ottawa. Just 1 week to go before the start of the world's largest chamber music festival, the Ottawa International Chamber Music Festival begins July 26th. 110 concerts will be presented over the 2 weeks of the festival this year. One of the highlights is the gala opening concert next Saturday night, 10 pianos, 10 Steinway Grands on stage at the same time with 16 of Canada's top pianists. The lineup of string quartets is impressive as well. The Borodin, Tokyo, Emerson, St. Lawrence, and Juilliard string quartets will be here. And one of the great violinists in the world today, Ida Haendel, will also give a recital at this year's festival. For complete information about this year's Chamber Music Festival, you can visit this website, chamberfest.com, or pick up a festival brochure. Several bookstores and music stores are selling tickets and festival passes, as is Ticketmaster. The Chamber Music Festival begins July the 26th.
Hello, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to the best of Quirks and Quarks. That's right. For the rest of the summer, while you're sipping lemonade on the back deck, relaxing at the cottage, or traveling in the car, we'll be bringing you the best from the past season of Quirks and Quarks. Today we go back to a program from last November featuring our award-winning documentary on the science of climate change. This feature won the prestigious Walter Sullivan Award for Excellence in Science Journalism, presented by the American Geophysical Union. Plus, we'll hear more about climate change, this time in Africa, from a scientist who collects ice cores from the peak of Mount Kilimanjaro, and in Asia, where soot over China is changing the climate. We'll also learn how seals use sounds to distinguish the dangerous whales from the friendly ones. All this and more today on the best of Quirks and Quarks.
Taking action on climate change. Together, we can do it. On October 24th, the Government of Canada released the overview of the plan for achieving Canada's climate change targets. It focuses on new technologies, new opportunities, and investing in renewable resources, and working with all Canadians to use energy more efficiently. Tell us what you think. To get your copy...
If you watch TV, listen to the radio, or read the newspaper, you've probably heard a lot lately about the Kyoto Accord, the international agreement to lower the amount of carbon dioxide that humanity is putting into the atmosphere. Today, the Kyoto Accord is a controversial political issue. Whether to ratify the treaty or not, and how much it will cost us in jobs and dollars, are hotly debated topics across our nation. But despite the avalanche of stories in the media, most Canadians admit they don't really understand what the Kyoto Accord is really about. A recent opinion poll showed that two-thirds of Canadians feel they don't have enough information to decide whether or not they support Kyoto. And what they're hearing and reading generally doesn't help, as the debate becomes more polarized and filled with opposing opinions, like this recent TV commentary by the CBC's own Rex Murphy.
Why did we sign on to Kyoto? Did we sign on because of the science? But the science is only half science. Anyone, scientist or layman, who says climate change is a finished discipline, that it has the reliability or experimental grounding of the real sciences, is either dreaming or ignorant. So, we didn't sign on to it because of the science, because in any real meaning of the term, the science isn't ready yet.
Statements like that, which say the science isn't there yet, only help cloud the issue. So, today we're going to try to separate out the science from the rhetoric, get past the political posturing, and see what science can say for sure. As well, we'll look at some of the issues that are still open to interpretation and debate. And there still is some debate on this issue. Just this week, a group of scientists, sponsored by various oil companies, held a news conference in Ottawa to discuss their concerns about supporting the Kyoto Accord. Many of these were economic concerns, but some related to the science of climate change. We'll go through some of those in a moment. But first, there are at least three things that everyone, even most of the skeptics, seem to agree on. One, the global average temperature has gone up by almost 1 degree over the last century. Two, the amount of carbon dioxide present in the atmosphere has increased by about 30% over that same time period. Three, some of that extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere comes from the burning of fossil fuels by humans. Now, these scientific facts come from reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC. These IPCC reports are a summary of data collected from all the leading climate scientists around the world. More than 100 researchers actually sat down to write each of these reports, and they consulted with several hundred more to collect their facts. Each report was then sent out to hundreds more scientists who reviewed the data and critiqued the report. Dr. Andrew Weaver is a Canada Research Chair in Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Victoria and one of the Canadians involved in writing the latest IPCC report. How confident is he that the data presented is accurate?
Oh, 100% confident. I mean, they're very careful. There's probabilities associated with statements. The terms like likely and very likely are defined in terms of probabilities. I mean, this is the best you're going to get of the state of climate science.
So, let's look at some of the data in the IPCC report. It's hard for anyone to dispute the rise in temperature or the increase in carbon dioxide measured in the atmosphere over the last 100 years. After all, these are actual physical measurements. For the last century, we've kept temperature records in many parts of the world. And while individual places might show different patterns of rising or falling, overall, the average temperature of the Earth has risen by about 1 degree Celsius. And there are similar records for the increase of carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. The other thing scientists all agree on is the source of the carbon dioxide. Even non-scientists know that. In fact, the Premier of Alberta, Ralph Klein, got it partially right in a recent speech on global warming.
There's all kinds of arguments, you know, relative to the science and the validity of the science as it affects this stuff that we're exhaling, going into the atmosphere and the stratosphere and contributing to global warming. You know, there are the scientists who say that, my God, we had an ice age. There was a time when the Arctic was the tropics. You know what caused that? Dinosaur farts? I don't know.
Believe it or not, Ralph Klein wasn't far off the mark in his comments about farting dinosaurs. The source of fossil fuels does lie in our prehistory. Dr. Weaver.
Back when the dinosaurs roamed the Earth, back in the Cretaceous, the Jurassic, Triassic period, carbon dioxide levels were much, much higher than they were today, 4 or 5 times the present levels. Now, what we're doing here is what happened in the past is this high level of carbon in the atmosphere was actually stored. The plant life died and became coal. It became gas. It became oil. And it drew down that carbon dioxide. So recently, we haven't had very high levels. Certainly not in the last 20 million years have we been as high as we are today. So now we're turning around and releasing that carbon dioxide, which was stored on millions of year timescale, on the timescale of a few decades.
So far, so good. At this point, almost everyone, whether they think the Kyoto Accord is a good idea or not, is still going to be able to agree. But now, as we move from things we can measure in the past to things we're predicting about the future, the scientists become divided. There are a handful of issues on which scientists disagree. One, how big a role do humans play in the overall carbon cycle? Two, can the computer models used in the IPCC reports accurately predict the future climate? And three, how much impact will an increase in temperature of 1 or 2 degrees actually have on our world and us? Okay, let's look at these one at a time. The first point of contention is how much humans contribute to the global climate cycle. Well, to begin, you have to know that there is carbon dioxide naturally in our atmosphere. In fact, without it, the Earth would freeze. This carbon dioxide is moving in and out of our atmosphere all the time. It's taken up by plants and bacteria and turned into materials that help them grow. After passing through the food chain, it's released back into the atmosphere when things decay. Other natural processes like forest fires and even our breathing also release carbon dioxide. But as Dr. Weaver pointed out, The carbon dioxide released when we burn fossil fuels is on top of all this. One of the scientists who doesn't support the Kyoto Protocol is Dr. Chris DeFreitas from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. He thinks the human contribution to the global climate system isn't big enough to be concerned about.
In terms of the carbon cycle, human beings are small players. And there are many, many other things involved in the world, in natural processes that contribute in a major way to carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, and for that matter, other greenhouse gases as well. So I think it's misleading to think that humans are all important in this regard and that anything we do is going to send shudders through the global atmospheric system. In fact, all our evidence, and most climatologists would agree with this, the global climate system is a very stable system.
The system may be generally stable, but Dr. Weaver thinks that's only true when everything is balanced. He agrees that humans don't add a lot of carbon dioxide compared to the total cycle, but unlike Dr. DeFreitas, he thinks our emissions are very important.
These are small, but it's in addition to the natural carbon cycle. So it's irrelevant in some sense to say it's small compared to the natural carbon cycle, because this is above the natural carbon cycle. If you have a dam with a whole bunch of water in there, and you have a nice flow into this reservoir and a nice flow out of the reservoir, you could say that the amount of water in the reservoir is huge. But it doesn't mean if you suddenly put water in and the reservoir overflows and it breaks, that little bit of extra water you're putting into the reservoir isn't important. It's the same thing with carbon dioxide.
Sorting out which of these two opinions is correct is difficult to do without considering the next criticism leveled at the science of climate change. That's the question of computer modeling. Dr. DeFreitas.
This is at the core of many of the arguments, is that the models to which the IPCC refer, these are global climate models, are hypothetical models. They haven't been verified. They don't work well. And that's because the global climate system is very complex. I mean, the models work not very much differently to weather prediction models. I know we can't predict weather 5 days ahead, let alone climate 100 years hence. So our models don't work well, so they're hypotheses until they're proven correct.
This is a very serious charge to level at the IPCC report. After all, it's the computer models that give us the predictions of future climate conditions. Simulating climate is a complicated matter. To set up a good model, you need to really understand what's going on in our atmosphere. That means thinking about more than just what gases are cycling up and down. You have to understand wind patterns and the effects of the sun shining down on the planet. Climate models need to account for the water that's found in clouds. Then there are the effects on the surface, the heat that comes from buildings, the reflected heat coming off the snow in winter, and the list goes on and on. It's no wonder that giant supercomputers are needed to build accurate climate forecasts. This complexity is reflected in the range of models presented in the IPCC reports. Based on a doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the overall temperature of the Earth could rise by anywhere from 1.5 to 4.5 degrees over the next 100 years. This might initially seem like a wide range of possibilities, but it's forecasting a long way in the future. If we look over a shorter range of time, the results are a lot clearer. Dr. Weaver.
If you look at the question, instead of saying at the year 2100, I mean, one important thing is all these models say warming, and you can actually define what is the likelihood of it going below 1.5 degrees, and it's extraordinarily slim. But if you actually then say, what about if we look at the policy-relevant question, which is what happens at the year 2030? The models don't differ. They say, basically, a very, very similar result, irregardless of what scenario you use, and similarly, what model you use, depending on how you look at it. So why this is important is that we're all focusing on the spread at 2100. And of course, things diverge, but at 2030, they all tie in quite closely.
All the models show that we can expect to see continued warming over the next 30 or so years. Even so, critics of modeling point out that there are still things we cannot accurately estimate, such as how much heat the ocean will absorb, or the role of sunspots in climate. But they're all being actively studied to try to measure their effects. Gradually, their roles are becoming clearer. One example that's recently moved forward is our understanding of the effect of aerosols. Aerosols are tiny particles that float around in the air. They can be dust off the ground or tiny water droplets off the oceans, or even chemicals produced when we burn fossil fuels. And they have two big effects on the atmosphere. First of all, they can directly block out sunlight. And secondly, aerosols act as starting points for cloud droplets. In both cases, they reflect solar energy away from the Earth and have the overall effect of cooling the climate. Critics of Kyoto say that could counterbalance the global warming and should be included in any climate models. But here's a problem with modeling them. When you study the physics of aerosols and plug this information into a computer model of climate, you get a cooling that's much too big. The models don't match reality. So Dr. Ulrike Lohmann has taken a look at this problem. She's an associate professor in atmospheric sciences at Dalhousie University in Halifax. She's used new satellite data to measure the effects of real aerosols in the atmosphere and discovered that what we thought we knew about aerosol clouds from the models was wrong.
What we have seen in this new satellite data, that there is a leveling off effect that we haven't captured. So the more and more aerosols you have, at one point it doesn't matter. The clouds just don't become any brighter anymore. There is a saturation effect to it. And that's what we couldn't simulate with our model. So we now have to go back and see what's wrong in the way that we have treated it, that our clouds don't seem to stop at a certain thickness or, optical depth, so to speak, and don't reflect any more solar radiation back to space.
When we modeled clouds, we assumed that as they got thicker, they reflected more and more light, which would lead to more cooling. But Dr. Lohmann has shown this isn't the case. There's actually a maximum amount of light that a cloud will reflect. Thanks to this study, Dr. Lohmann has given the climate modeling community an important new set of data to add to their models. But these are still just predictions. And since they're looking into the future, the best way to test them is to wait 100 years or so and see if the outcome matches what you predicted. That, however, is not necessarily a practical approach. Well, there's another model that has been running for 4.5 billion years now. It's called the Earth. Another way of evaluating the computer models is to compare them to our own planet. After all, if we look back 100 years, we know the conditions then, we know what the world is like now, and we can generate equations to explain what's happened in between. These equations form a sort of climate simulation, but one based simply on what we've seen the Earth do. And that's what Dr. Jonathan Gregory's done. He's a climate modeler at the Hadley Center in England. By studying the recent history of the Earth, he's shown that we really will see a future warming of at least a degree and a half, as predicted by the computer models. He thinks this is important in proving the case for global warming.
I think that the work that we've done, and similar work that other people have done over the last year, which is aiming at getting an answer more from the real world, is helpful because it's giving a convergence, if you like, with the results that come from models. So that increases our certainty because we've come up with a bound of around 1.5 degrees, and so have other people. And that's, again, this similar to the lower bound that comes from the three-dimensional climate models. All these pieces of evidence pointing in the same direction probably increases our confidence that the climate sensitivity is not less than that.
This is good news for the climate modelers, bad news for their critics. Dr. Gregory and others like him are showing that the climate models used to predict the future are coming up with very similar answers to ones we can generate by looking at the past. Which leaves one last criticism. Those scientists who don't support Kyoto suggest that an increase of 1 or 2 degrees isn't going to cause a catastrophe for the Earth. They argue that the world has been warmer in the past and that humans actually like a warmer climate. But that 1 degree rise is only a global average. What happens locally can be quite a different thing. Dr. Weaver.
What does 1 degree warming mean? Well, it means amplified much more at high latitudes relative to low latitudes. It's amplified in the middle of continents relative to near oceans, which mitigate change. It's amplified in the winter relative to the summer. And it's amplified at night, people think, relative to day. In addition, when you have warmer atmosphere at these middle to high latitudes, the atmosphere is this more moisture holding capacity before saturation occurs. So as has been observed over places like northern Canada, et cetera, over the 20th century. And into the future, one would expect increased precipitation, especially in the winter, and increased extreme precipitation events. These things we have a good deal of confidence in.
A change of a fraction of a degree near the equator may translate into 5 or 6 degrees in the Arctic. And while we can't predict exactly what the effects of this will be, it's pretty unlikely the outcome will be good. The other part of this issue is the rate at which we're heating the Earth. Previous warming cycles have taken thousands or even millions of years. Today's rate of warming can be measured in decades. In the history of the Earth, we've got nothing comparable to this modern change. So making specific predictions is very difficult. So here's where we stand after all this. Pretty much everyone agrees on the basics. There has been warming over the last century. Carbon dioxide levels have risen, and humans have played a part in putting that carbon dioxide there. Everything else is merely a matter of interpretation. And a lot of that interpretation is going to come down to whether or not you trust the models. Critics say we can't prove anything with modeling studies, and that's true. In science, it's rarely possible to prove anything definitively. But Dr. Gregory thinks there's enough evidence there to take the science seriously.
A scientific conclusion is never completely certain, but with the tools that are available, you try to do the best job that you can. There's a very large scientific consensus about, at least qualitatively, that we expect to see substantial global warming if we continue to emit greenhouse gases. That's not a view that is absolutely universally held, but it is held by a very large majority of people working in the field. And those people are all experts. Scientists are, of course, trained and habitually used to being critical of their own and other people's results. So it's not the case that people are simply accepting these numbers. The system is quite self-scrutinizing. So it's not a conclusion that has been lightly arrived at. So while we can't be certain, it does represent a very strong body of opinion in the scientific world.
As Dr. Gregory points out, scientific consensus is not just a bunch of scientists sitting around trying to make sure everyone has the same point of view. It's arrived at by careful analysis of data and with lots of questioning. Warming is real, and it's here already. What's left to decide is what to do about it. So, we're back to the political rhetoric we started with. It's human nature to resist change. So some of those who think we should take warming seriously have chosen to present the worst-case scenarios to encourage us to change. They talk about the melting of the ice caps or droughts in the prairies. The media tend to pick up these as headlines and not report the more cautious statements that the majority of scientists tend to make. This opens the door for critics who say we're overreacting and that global climate change won't have the dramatic effect that we're hearing about. And that the Earth naturally heats and cools, this is just one of those cycles, so we don't need to change anything. But here's something to think about. Yes, the world has warmed and cooled in the past. This has usually happened slowly, and as it happened, it changed the landscape, wiped out dominant groups of species, and left the world a very different place. Today, we are the dominant species. It's up to us to decide whether or not we want to take the risk that we'll be able to adapt to a new climate. Coming up next, getting to the core of the problem. If you want to study the history of climate, one of the best ways to do this is to look at samples of ice. Changes in climate over a long period of time leave footprints in the ice that give clues to the past. So if you set out to look for those clues, Africa would probably not be the place that immediately jumps to mind. Unless, of course, you looked on the top of a very high mountain. That's where Dr. Lonnie Thompson does his research. He's a professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at Ohio State University. By collecting ice samples from the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, he's been able to work out some of the details of the history of Africa's climate. Dr. Thompson, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, how does studying ice tell you about climate?
Well, ice, I believe, is our best recorder of the past. If you go high enough where the temperatures are cold, the ice doesn't melt, and each year there's a layer of snow that accumulates. And in that layer are isotopes that tell us the temperature of the past, but also dust layers, volcanic horizons of past eruptions that are recorded in the tephra, and the sulfates that you can measure in the chemistry in the ice. But in the tropics, we are also lucky to have both pollen and also plant fragments, and in some cases, insects that are perfectly preserved in these cores.
How far back in time can you go by drilling the ice cores?
Well, the oldest core, we have six cores that were drilled to bedrock from the remaining ice fields on the summit, and the oldest record goes back to about 11,700 years before present.
So after you got the ice cores down and they're intact and they're in your freezer, when you started looking at them, what did they tell you about the past climate of Africa?
Well, there's been a tremendous change in climate in that part of the world. Back 9,500 years ago, there were tremendous lakes and rivers in this area. Lake Chad, which exists today and covers about 17,000 square kilometers, back at this time covered over 350,000 square kilometers. So it was over 40 times bigger, and so there was a lot of water, and it was when this water and this area was wet that these glaciers actually grew on Kilimanjaro. But as you come forward in time, there are three very large droughts that are recorded, one at about 8,300 years before present. This particular one was about 300 years in length. And then if you come forward in time, there was another very sharp drought and cold event centered around 5,200 years before present. And this shows up as a cold event in the isotope record from the cores. It's the lowest values that we have in the entire 11,700-year history. And it turns out this is a very interesting period of time, because it's the time, if you talk with archaeologists and anthropologists, that the first cities were being formed in this region. And some of the theories on this is that before this, humans were hunters and gatherers, and for some reason they were forced into river valleys and in higher concentrations where they had to have a structure that we now call cities. So the nice thing of working in an area where there is a long human history is that you can reference events that you see in the cores to what was happening in documented history. And the biggest drought in these cores actually occurs around 4,200 years before present. And the event is well recorded in the history of Egypt, for example. It's the division between the Old Kingdom, the pharaohs and the pyramids, and the Middle Kingdom. It represents a collapse of a civilization before a new one was reestablished. And there's writings from this period of time. They talk about sand dunes moving across the Nile River, people migrating north and south looking for food, pharaohs not allowing their children to go out because they would be killed. So it was a time that some archaeologists refer to as the first Dark Ages for the Earth, because it's not only in Egypt. If you look at the records in the Middle East, the Akkadian culture collapsed at this time. You look at the records along the Indus River Valley in India, a major collapse. And in this paper in Science, we also showed another tropical ice core record from South America, from Huascarán. And the biggest dust event in the last 17,000 years occurs at this same period of time in South America. And if you look at the archaeological records in that area, you also find it's the division between the pre-ceramic period and the initial period, but a period of a cultural collapse in that area. So something very large scale was going on in the tropics 4,200 years ago, a drought that lasted about, 300 years. Wow, it's unimaginable to think of a drought lasting that long. We talk now about drought years. You know, here you're talking about centuries. Well, and this is very important to understand the nature of these, because cultures and civilizations can adapt to years and even multiple years. But when you talk about these long periods of time, we really do need to understand what caused these events in the past, and particularly when you look at the fact that 4,200 years ago, there were very few people living on the planet, maybe 250 million compared to 6.2 billion people who live on the planet today, and 70% of those people live in the tropics. So if these natural events could occur in the past, certainly they can occur in the future. So I think understanding the nature of these becomes very important.
What then about the future for the climate in Africa as you see it?
If things continue as they have since 1912, then the ice fields on Kilimanjaro will disappear sometime between 2015 and 2020. And if that occurs, of course, we now know that'll be unusual in the time perspective of 11,700 years. The ice has been there continuously over that period of time. So if it does disappear, it suggests that something unusual is happening.
So you're saying even though these incredible droughts that lasted 300 years hit in the past, the snow was still on Kilimanjaro, but today the snow is disappearing?
Yes, I think that's something that makes even the 4,200-year event different than what we see happening there today.
Dr. Thompson, thank you very much for your time.
And thank you.
Dr. Lonnie Thompson is a professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at Ohio State University and a researcher in the Byrd Polar Research Center. I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks, the national science program heard every Saturday on CBC Radio 1, on shortwave via Radio Canada International, and live on the Internet at cbc.ca. If you'd like to order a cassette or CD copy of the program, or a Quirks t-shirt, lab coat, or a mouse pad, just call our info line to get all the details. It's 416-205-2495. That's 416-205-2495. Earlier in the program, we examined global climate change, but scientists are increasingly understanding climate change on a smaller scale as well, regional climate change. Well, recently, a team from the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies discovered that climate change in Asia was linked to an aerosol particle in the atmosphere, a particle we commonly know as soot. The rapid industrialization of southern China and population increase in India have led to much higher levels of soot from coal, diesel engines, wood burning, and even the burning of dung for fuel. The researchers discovered that this fine soot, known to scientists as aerosol black carbon, has probably contributed to the recent massive flooding in southern China and the fierce droughts that have plagued northern Asia. Dr. Sarabi Menon was a member of the team that made the discovery. She's an associate research scientist at Columbia University and at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. Dr. Menon, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you.
First of all, why did you even start looking at soot as a possible influence on the climate in Asia?
Well, we were interested in looking at Asia because these were the regions where the emissions have been increasing in recent decades. And also, at the same time, there has been this climate pattern which has been observed over China, which is the increased flooding to the south and the droughts, dust storms, which take place in the north. So we were interested in trying to see if there was any correlation between the aerosols and the climate change pattern that you see there. So that's how we started looking at simulations which try to look into the effect that the aerosols, which were mostly black carbon, we just wanted to see what role that these aerosols have on the climate change that we see there.
Well, what are these black carbon aerosols and where do they come from?
Black carbon mostly comes about from incomplete combustion from both fossil fuels as well as biomass burning. So in China, there's a large incidence of low-temperature household burning of biofuels and coal, whereas in India it's mostly from agricultural waste and dung, and also it comes from the diesel engines. Measurements which have been taken in the recent past have shown that the levels there are quite high and have been increasing.
So what did you do in your study to simulate this and understand what the carbon was doing?
What we did, to begin our simulations, we used observations, which tells you how much aerosols are present in the atmosphere, and that the measurements that we used were from observations over China. And over India, we used data from satellite retrievals, as well as from a chemical transport model, which kind of gives you the distribution over land and ocean. So we used a combination of these different techniques to predict a distribution of aerosols over China and India. Mm-hmm. And then we use another distribution which represents the aerosols in the 1950s, so these are going to be much lower. And then we look at, we run the climate model for several years, and the difference between these simulations, the present day, which is the measurements that we've used, and that of the distribution from the 1950s, tells us what present day emissions are doing to climate. And then we use these results to tell us the impact of recent emissions on climate trends of the last 50 years.
So basically you ran two simulations, one with lots of particles in the air that you have today,
yes,
and one that where the air is basically clean.
Much cleaner. I wouldn't call it clean, but much, much cleaner.
Relatively clean, right?
Yes, yes. So, because there are lots of natural aerosols as well, so...
So how is the black carbon causing that the droughts and the flooding?
Well, because these black carbons are the absorbing aerosols, as I mentioned. They absorb sunlight, and they use that energy to heat up the atmosphere. So there's low-level heating, and so there's large-scale lifting of the air masses, and clouds form more easily in such cases and bring rain. And this happens to take place in the southern parts of China where there's these pollutants or these black carbon aerosols. And since this air mass, there's this large-scale lifting of the air masses, they have to sink someplace else. So they do that to the north and to the south. And when air masses sink, you don't have clouds forming, so there's less rain. We tend to show less rainfall to the north, where you had the droughts and the dust storms, and increased rain to the south, which also happens to be the region where there's increased flooding.
So you have a huge cycle here where the black carbon is being produced. The black absorbs sunlight, makes the air hot. The air rises because it's
yes.
warm. And then it because it rises, it drops moisture, causes rain. But then it circles around and comes back down. But when it comes down, it doesn't have any moisture. So
yeah,
then it returns again. So you have this giant big cycle going on there, big circle.
Yes, right, exactly.
So what could be done about this?
Well, unlike CO2 gases, which stay in the atmosphere for several decades, with aerosols, the lifetime is of the order of a week or less. So they can be, if steps are taken to control the emissions, you could see the effects pretty soon. So if there is cleaner combustion or the change of burning practices, for example, instead of to using biofuels to use more natural gas and things like this, one could reduce the emissions and the effects could be seen pretty soon.
We hear about so many different influences when it comes to climate change. You get the greenhouse gases and whatnot. How does the effect of this black carbon or soot fit into that whole picture?
The difference is that the CO2 or greenhouse gases, they stay in the atmosphere for a longer time. So even if you stop the emissions now, it's going to take a long time for it to stabilize and tend to reduce their impact on temperature. Whereas with the aerosols, since they're short-lived and they're more regional, if you stop the emissions, the results are much quicker to see.
Dr. Menon, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Surabhi Menon is an associate research scientist at Columbia University and the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Her research on the influence of soot particles on the Asian climate appeared in the journal Science. Coming up next... Learning a second language is always difficult, and perhaps one of the most difficult parts is motivation. Memorizing all that vocabulary, the drudgery of mastering the subjunctive tense, that becomes so tiresome. Well, what we need is the kind of motivation SEALs off the west coast of British Columbia have. If they don't master a foreign language, specifically the language of killer whales, they get eaten. Apparently it's a very powerful motivator, because the SEALs have become so adept at understanding whale talk that they can even distinguish whale dialects. Volker Dike is a research associate at the Vancouver Aquarium Marine Science Center. This week he published his research on the SEALs' remarkable linguistic abilities in the journal Nature. Mr. Dike, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you.
How did you first get an idea that SEALs might be listening in on killer whale songs?
Well, actually, my background and the background of my co-authors, John Ford and Peter Slater, is in the vocal behavior of killer whales. And John and I have certainly spent a lot of time studying the resident, the fish-eating killer whales. For my PhD thesis, I wanted to look at the mammal-eating killer whales. But I noticed very quickly that these animals are extremely silent. I spent up to 8 hours following groups, and I didn't record a single squawk from them. In the beginning, I thought, oh, God, this is my thesis down the drain. But then we actually gave our heads a shake, and we thought, this is actually quite interesting on its own.
So there are actually two different groups of killer whales on the West Coast?
That's correct, yeah. In British Columbia, we've got a very interesting situation where we've got two populations of the same species that live in the same waters, travel very much in the same habitat, but behave completely differently. The so-called residents feed on fish, predominantly on salmon in the summer and fall months. The transient killer whales live in the same water, but they exclusively feed on marine mammals like harbor seals, sea lions, porpoises, but also some of the larger whales.
Okay, and you're saying that these transient ones don't talk much. They don't have much of a language.
They do have a language, but they don't use it as frequently as the fish-eating ones. They often travel for hours silently, and we wanted to find out why that may be. An obvious explanation is, of course, that mammal-eating killer whales hunt a prey that has a very good underwater hearing. SEALs can certainly hear the calls of killer whales from a long distance. Fish-eating killer whales, on the other hand, they feed on animals that are essentially deaf to the frequencies of killer whale communication. So there's no cost for vocalizing. Talk is cheap, so to speak, for the fish-eating killer whales.
So how did you figure out that the SEALs are somehow figuring this out?
Well, we wanted to find out whether the SEALs actually respond to killer whale calls. So we did a controlled experiment where we played sequences that had calls of transient killer whales in it, and sequences that consisted just of background noise, and we found that the SEALs actually responded to the calls of the killer whales. Then we sat down and we thought, wow, SEALs living in areas that are frequented by the harmless, by the fish-eating killer whales, would be wasting a lot of time and energy if they responded to all killer whale calls indiscriminately. So we thought, well, let's find out if they actually respond to the calls of the local fish-eating killer whales.
So how did you actually do the experiment when you went out on the boat or whatever?
SEALs are very convenient to work with because they're driven by a natural curiosity. So what we would do is we would go to a SEAL haulout, a reef where SEALs usually haul out onto the land to sun themselves on rocks at low tide. And usually you'd find up to 20 or 30 SEALs in the water around these SEAL haulouts. And we drove up with our boat to one of these haulouts, dropped an anchor, and within a couple of minutes, a lot of SEALs would come and sit at a safe distance of about 20 to 50 meters and just watch us out of curiosity, we presume. We could then play the calls and see how the number of SEALs around the boat increased or decreased after we played the calls.
So what did you see when you played these different songs?
When we played the calls of mammal-eating killer whales, we witnessed a very strong response in the SEALs. the numbers decreased by usually around 40%, so 40% of the seals ducked away underwater straight away. When we played the calls of the local, the familiar fish-eating killer whales, the seals hardly responded at all. There was no change in the number of seals visible at the surface. But when we played the calls of unfamiliar fish-eating killer whales from Alaska, we witnessed a response that was as strong as that to mammal-eating killer whales.
Oh, so the seals are able to tell the difference between the whales that would be hunting them and strangers, and the whales that are there that are not a threat to them.
If you think of it from a seal's perspective, this is actually a very good strategy. Played conservative, respond to anything that you're not familiar with, but stop responding to those calls that you know and that are never followed by an attack. Because in order to achieve this discrimination, you really only have to learn the calls of harmless killer whales. Anything else you will respond to. And so you don't actually need to be involved in an attack in order to smarten up.
Well, how different are these whale songs?
They're actually quite different. The interesting thing is that different social groups within the local fish-eating population actually even have dialects of their own. And that, I think, is an interesting point in itself. But anyway, we can play some calls. This is an example of some mammal-eating killer whales.
Okay, those are the kind that the seals are afraid of.
Yes, definitely. And if we listen by comparison to the some calls of the local fish-eating population, they sound like this.
Okay. didn't sound hugely different to me. No. Okay, now what about the third kind, the strangers from Alaska?
Okay, here we go.
Boy, those differences are very subtle. I mean, it's not like, you know, one's making a really high sound, one's making a really low sound.
Yeah, it is definitely, and it took John Ford his PhD thesis to figure out the differences, and now we're finding that the seals knew it all along.
Boy, that's amazing. It's sort of like saying how a dog could distinguish between Portuguese and Spanish or something.
Yeah, which probably they some dogs at least can. Yeah, but again, you know, the interesting thing is that even different fish-eating groups sound quite different from each other, and the variation within the local fish-eating population is probably as great as the difference between fish eaters and mammal eaters. And that really shows that the seals are learning individual calls rather than, you know, using some gross feature of the calls in order to make the difference.
Were you surprised by this ability of the seals to discriminate sounds like that?
Definitely we were surprised, because it is quite a feat. You know, it's been shown that animals can often recognize dialects in the vocalizations of conspecifics, members of their own species, but that one species can actually gain some insights about the identity of members of another species, that's something that I found quite fascinating. If you think of it, though, because the costs are so high, you know, you could be losing your life if you snooze. It does certainly make sense, but it's still, I find it amazing that the seals have actually managed to achieve this.
Mr. Dickey, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Volker Dickey is a research associate at the Vancouver Aquarium Marine Science Center and a PhD student at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And now it's time for the Quirks and Quarks question of the week. Yes, this is your chance to challenge the experts, and this week we have a question about a mystery of the heart.
This is Shirley Hahn from Vancouver. Of all the different types of cancer that we hear about, I can't recall ever hearing about someone afflicted with heart cancer. Does it occur? And if not, why not? And if it does occur, why does it occur less frequently than other cancers? Thank you.
For the answer, we go to the London Regional Cancer Center, where Dr. Vivian Bramwell is a medical oncologist. So, Dr. Bramwell, we don't hear about cancer of the heart. Does it ever happen?
It
does occur, but it is rare. When it does occur, it's a type of cancer called a sarcoma, and sarcomas are about 1% of all cancers, and heart sarcomas are even rarer than that.
So why does the heart not have as much cancer as other parts of the body do?
Well, sarcomas in general are derived from structural tissues of the body, such as soft tissues, bones, muscles, and so on, whereas carcinomas, the other type of cancer, tend to occur on body surfaces. On the body surfaces, cells tend to turn over quite rapidly, cells of the gut or cells of the lung, or what we call proliferating or growing all the time, whereas the structural cells tend not to be doing that. And it may be that these rapidly proliferating cells are more susceptible to developing cancer.
Oh, so you're saying that cells that reproduce a lot, that divide a lot, are the ones that get cancer more than those that don't?
Yes, that's generally true.
So what is it about cells that divide a lot that would make them more prone to cancer?
Well, it may be that there's more opportunity for genetic mistakes to occur.
When you say cell, surface cells, you mean like I think of skin,
and we
certainly do hear about skin cancer. That's what you're talking about.
Surface and also internal surfaces. So the internal surfaces of the lung, for example, or the internal surfaces of the gut. All those cells are turning over quite rapidly and being shed all the time. But when you look at the heart, as I say, the cells aren't turning over very much. The only thing they're exposed to is the blood, and the blood is rapidly cleansed through the kidneys. It isn't in contact very long. The heart's beating rapidly, so it's moving the blood along all the time. If you contrast it with something like the GI tract, cancers most commonly occur in the GI tract or in the stomach or in the large bowel, the colon, and that's where food can sit for some periods of time, either in the stomach itself or in the colon before it's evacuated. If you look at the small bowel, which is in between the colon and the stomach, food passes through that very rapidly, and you actually rarely get cancers occurring in the small bowel. And when they do occur, they're actually sarcomas.
Oh, so in the rare cases where the heart does get cancer, what causes it?
Possibly a genetic predisposition, but that hasn't really been proven. These tumors are very rare. And therefore, you know, the opportunity to study them and their molecular composition has been fairly limited.
Dr. Bramwell, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Vivian Bramwell is a medical oncologist at the London Regional Cancer Center and a professor at the University of Western Ontario. Now, we take all your questions, so send them in. If your question is used on the show, you get a copy of the Quirks Question Book. We'll give you the addresses in just a minute. And that's it for this edition of The Best of Quirks and Quarks. This Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. on Primetime Quirks, we'll hear how Flushing pharmaceuticals may be polluting our water. And of course, tune in again next Saturday at this time when we'll have more of The Best of Quirks and Quarks from this past season. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can write to P.O. Box 500, Station A, Toronto, Ontario, M5W1E6. Our email is quirks@cbc.ca. And the number to call if you want information on purchasing any Quirks merchandise or a CD or cassette copy of the program is 416-205-2495. And to get to our webpage, just go to cbc.ca/quirks. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Jim Hanman, Jim Lebbins, and Pat Sensen. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
I'm Judy Madryn, and you're listening to CBC Radio 1. There is a lot of interesting radio on the web, including CBC Radio. And this week on Global Village, Joey introduces us to Métis Radio on the web. Ethiopian musicians stage their own Live Aid, stories for Body and Soul from Brazil and Morocco, a postcard from Natasha Atlas, a profile of Jane Bennett, wow, and new music from Oliver Mutukudzi and Suad Masi. That's Global Village, 7, 6 Atlantic, 6:30 Newfoundland.